Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your once again fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, I'm chatting to director Christopher Allender, writer Marcus Gabriel, and producer Justin Ross about their new possession horror, The Old Ways, which is currently streaming on Netflix. Over the course of the interview, you will hear me talk to the trio about the long journey to land the lead actress of the movie, Bridget Callie Canales, how Christopher and Marcus taught themselves to do effects on the fly, and how they were determined to make a possession movie with a fresh twist. Plus, we have a variety of tangents on a variety of subjects, including Escape from LA, English muffins, and at one point I end up being the interviewee, which is a strange twist for an edition of this podcast. Also, Christopher and Marcus tell me how it is making the transition from going from working with the Muppets to working on a horror movie, all of which and much, much more you can hear right now in my interview with Christopher, Marcus, and Justin. Hi, Chris.
Hello. How you doing?
Good to have you on the show. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, sir.
And hi, Justin.
Hello.
Right. So I've got you. That's usually I just do one interviews. Last time I've done something like this big, it was when I interviewed the Radio Silence for the Ready or Not. So
love those guys.
Yeah, I've got you all on the show today to talk about your film, The Old Ways. So I don't know which one of the three of you want to go first to give us a brief spoiler-free synopsis for the audience of The Old Ways.
I'll let Marcus do it.
Okay, Marcus.
You did it last time. You did a good job.
He's the wordsmith.
The Old Ways. Yeah, The Old Ways is about a reporter named Cristina Lopez who kind of returns home to her ancestral home in Veracruz, Mexico, kind of searching after a story about local maybe witchcraft and brujeria and things like that. And while she's there, she gets abducted by a few people who believe she has a demon inside of her and aren't going to release her until they've properly gotten the demon out. So that's the quick setup for The Old Ways.
And Marcus, as the writer of the film, what was the initial inspiration behind your screenplay?
I had been trying to, for a while, Chris and I, the director, we've known each other for a long, long time, and we were trying to figure out a cool project we could do together that we could shoot on a soundstage that we have access to, and trying to think of something that would be really fun and scary and interesting for us to do. And for that, I kind of went back into some stories that my mother had told me of her childhood in Puerto Rico, of brujas, of like spiritual cleansings and things like that. And really fascinating things. So for a while I'd been trying to think like, how do I work something like this into a story? And when I started to think of it at the scale that we were trying to make, I realized if we made kind of an exorcism story from a different cultural point of view, from a more of a Latin or Hispanic point of view, that everything would then freshen up and become a lot more exciting and interesting and dangerous because we don't know exactly what's going to happen next. And I love all horror movies. I definitely love exorcism movies, but sometimes they get into the same kind of familiar tropes of, you know, we got the priest coming in and he's got a special order from the Vatican and then they're going to bring another guy.
It always comes from that Catholic lore.
Yes, exactly. And it comes from that point of view. And we just wanted to, you know, in writing the story, just do everything slightly differently. and not fall into those same sort of trappings, but still kind of deliver on that exciting, scary experience.
And in terms of, were you kind of working off those tales that you were told by your mom, or did you do further research into like the kind of Mexican mythology or anything like that, you know, being set in Mexico?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of it, there are some little hints and sprinkles of things that my mom had told me, but then just kind of heightened to the next level. Yeah. And then, yeah, just researching, really looking at spiritual practices of the region. That's where it really got to be fun. So some of it, what you'll see in the movie are things that you may have seen in other kind of footage or documentaries or things you're familiar with, things like psychic surgeries, things like these spiritual cleansings with sprays of holy water or herbs and things like that. And then we just kind of heightened everything as far as it could possibly go. And that was really a lot of the fun of it. So the script was kind of written and became our roadmap and our blueprint. And then Chris and some of our other producers as well, but Chris really loved to get in there from like almost like an archaeological perspective of really like digging into the research, the region, finding new things. And in that way, the script was always sort of a living document, because he would find in his research, there's something in the movie called the death whistle, which makes this crazy sound. And he would go like, oh my God, do you know that this is in this region? Can we work a death whistle into it? Of course. Yeah, let's try it. The design of the creature was based on a lot of research into the area. With our performers, you know, we would show them footage of spiritual healings and spiritual practices, and they would work that into their interpretation of the characters and in those moments. So this film is certainly a documentary. Every frame is true, not a false word is spoken. But we did try to, yeah, definitely dig into and surround ourselves in the culture and the research of the region, and then let that guide a lot of the decisions in the story.
And yeah, in fact, I was going to say the region that we chose, actually Veracruz, mm-hmm. Was very specific because it is a place that has this overlapping of all these different cultures. So we do have a bit of Catholicism in there because of the Spanish Empire and all that. But then you also have, because they're on the east coast of Mexico, they have the Afro-Caribbean influence. It's mm-hmm. right on the edge of the Mayan and Aztec empires. So there's a lot of overlap from ancient Mexico and then sort of a slightly more recent time periods. And the real fun thing about the brujeria that we discovered is there was no one book like in Catholicism. Mm-hmm. So each bruja or brujo kind of develops their own local versions of how to deal with any sort of evil spirits or hexes or anything like that. So it really gave us a ton of freedom there to pick and choose things that we thought would be most cinematic and most rich for the story and embellish those things and not be contradicting some, you know, masterwork that says this is how it has to be every way. So that was really fun, I think, creatively for us and for the rest of the team as they were putting stuff together.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I like how you so specifically chose Veracruz for those reasons. I did. That's one of the things I really liked about the film, that it did feel like, you know, some horror films that are either set in Latin America or set in South America or whatever. It's just like, it's just a case of like, this is an exotic location. Whereas it, you know, never felt like that in this movie.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And in early versions of the script, it definitely just said jungle. And as we did more research and found the things that we really wanted to hone in on, and one of our producers, Krista, who's from Guatemala, mm-hmm. which is close to that region, she really kept pushing us as well to say, where is this? So as we kind of narrowed it down to the things we wanted, then we started researching on the map, and we actually found there's a town in Veracruz called Catemaco that is actually the brujo capital of the world. And they have a witch festival, and people come from all over.
It's amazing.
Latin America to get treatments, and you know, I think half of it's tongue in cheek and half of it is 100% they believe it. So yeah, it's a really rich area that has a lot to offer and checked off all the boxes for us as far as the story was concerned and the plotting and the world building.
And I know that you're Chris, you're both a producer and a director. Were you always going to direct this one?
Yeah. That we definitely developed this to be a vehicle for us to create together at our studio and kind of lean into all of the resources that we've been cultivating over the last 20 years or so of living in Hollywood, and the relationships that we've built and the equipment that we've purchased and the spaces that we've got access to and stuff like that. So to really take that indie film approach a little bit, working backwards, you know, from, well, what do we have and what can we do at the level that we want to execute at. And so this was very much like just working on it until it was ready to be made instead of shopping it around and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, even, you know, I remember I wrote the first maybe 10 pages of the script right off of just like, I think this is an idea. I think this is a thing that I'd like to continue to write, and presented that to Chris, you know, as the collaboration started right in the beginning, to just be like, hey man, here's where it's going. Here's where I think it's going to keep going. Does this feel like a thing you'd want to do? Because that would encourage me to continue to move it forward. Because, you know, we have different opportunities sometimes to develop projects for like, you know, hey, maybe the studios are like this or maybe this. And those guys, those things go into development for like a billion years. And this one really felt like, we'd love to have cameras rolling on something and let's create something. So Chris was on board after those first few pages, and that was very encouraging, and then kept giving input. And then I kept writing it as we'd go along.
And how long did it take roughly? Was it a quick turnaround in terms of going into production from like kind of final draft of the script to like filming?
You guys would probably know that better than I.
I think we started writing it while we were producing. I mean, I know we started writing it while we were producing another film called Wildcat that was a little bit smaller scale, but a similar kind of chamber drama. And that, I believe, was that in mid 2018?
2018,
We were filming that, and it was such a good experience. It was a very small crew, very low budget. But we, in the past, we've always produced independent film. It's always been on location, and it looks great because you don't have to build a castle or wherever, you know, whatever it's gonna be. Because you don't have a lot of money, but it's also extremely arduous. Challenging because you don't have a ton of support, you don't have a ton of power, you don't have a ton of anything, and you're at the mercy of the elements and unscrupulous landowners and things like that. So this movie Wildcat was the first time we shot a small, like an independent film on a soundstage, and it was just great. I mean, it was a first time filmmaker who was directing, and he had just so much support and just a lot of the X factors that can derail an independent film were eliminated. So we were like, man, we got to do another one of these. So that's when he was writing it while I think we were still filming that one. And we literally were like, we're going to keep that wall and that wall in storage.
I think I had dreams that we were just going to like go straight from wrapping on Wildcat and go like right into the stage and be like, oh, let's repaint the walls and let's start shooting.
Yeah, and it felt like that the whole time. And then when you look at the calendar, it was a year and a half later probably. But I think maybe, I don't know, not long after that, we were starting to kind of rope in our team, Justin and David Visti, who's another producer, and Krista Borini, another producer, and Chelsea DeVincent, who's our line producer. And those people kind of were starting to get involved fairly quickly. And then we got into casting, which took some time. I think we started that late 2019.
Well, part of casting was like super fast. And then one part of casting took a lot of time.
Yeah, we found like the three characters who aren't the lead, we found them very quickly. with the help of our casting director. And then it took time and time again of going through people to find Bridget, who ended up being the lead of the movie. Yeah, we shot it. So we started shooting in end of January or beginning of February of 2020.
February.
And which was probably a year and a half approximately after we started writing. And then we wrapped about 2 days before the lockdown in Los Angeles for the quarantine. And we've been sitting in these rooms ever since.
And doing a whole press tour from these rooms, from the same rooms we made the movie in.
Yeah, we did all the post, all the VFX, all the color correction, and all the press, all from the same seat.
Okay, I can certainly imagine. I think we're all very much in the same boat, eh? I've not cut to you yet, Jason. Justin. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
All his friends call really him Jason.
Anyway.
Yeah.
J Dog.
What's up, J Dog? Jason.
Oh my God.
No, I know. I'm not going to let that down. How did you come on the project, Justin?
Oh. Thanks, Scott. we had just finished doing a film called The Mortuary Collection, which I think you spoke with my directing partner in that, Ryan Spindell, for an episode. And, we had just wrapped that production with the help of Soapbox and worked with these guys. And we knew them for quite some time. The majority of the production company kind of came from the Florida State film school world, and that's where Ryan and I met as well. So we've kind of stayed in touch over the years and recognized them as a partner that we wanted to work with. So when it came time for us to do Mortuary Collection, we teamed up and worked with them on that. And then when that wrapped, Chris and Marcus and a couple other folks came over and said, "Hey, what are you doing right now? you got a window in your schedule?" I'm like, "Yeah, for you guys, absolutely." So that's how I kind of get looped into the madness here. And I think as a producer, you always look for opportunities to continue to work with people that you like. And in this case, not only is the Soapbox team great, but some of the folks that we had on the Mortuary Collection, we're able to kind of loop in and just keep working with them on the next one, and bring a lot of the rock stars along for the ride. So I think every film that you do, you want to kind of level up and shed some of the team members that were not completely exceptional, and reward and bring along the team members that contributed, in a great way. And so a few of the people that worked on Mortuary Collection were able to bring along to the old ways and hopefully make that experience even better in the process.
Yeah. And Justin had he has a similar philosophy to us, which is the kind of no drama crew mentality. So it meshed really well with the way we like to make films. And David Visti and I had done another film together called The Wind that, like I said, I believe it played in the Edinburgh Film Festival a couple of years ago. So we all kind of have that idea of like, let's bring around people that we want on set who have positive attitudes and can do attitudes and are extremely creative and collaborative. And that really worked out for the best couple of movies in a row now. So we'll stick with it.
I was going to ask you, Chris, that you mentioned that it was quite a long road to get Bridget in the lead role. What was it about her that made you think that she was going to be perfect for this character?
Yeah, it was a hard character, which we started to realize very quickly in the casting, because Marcus had written her to be very tough, but also she's got this kind of broken background to her that makes her very vulnerable, and she's a little snarky and a little funny, but she also has to be very sensitive, and then physically demanding, very a lot of action in this movie for her. From a physical standpoint, and it was just kind of like we were asking for the world. So people would come in and be really, really good at this scene and this scene, and then we'd throw another scene at them, and it just didn't feel authentic. And then we'd get someone in who did the complete opposite, you know, it'd be like, oh, what's this? And then another scene would be amazing. And so we'd get all these people, and we were starting to get close to the shoot date, and we were like trying to narrow it down, and we'd all kind of vote, and we'd get, I think there were probably five or six of us maybe kind of weighing in on this. And we'd find people who get like four votes out of six and five votes out of six. But we could never get everybody on board. And so we were like, well, I guess we just haven't found the right person. It feels like with every other person we had on the cast, it was like, yeah, for sure. Everybody, you know, as soon as they were halfway done through the audition, we were like, yep. And we pushed the shoot date, and we pushed it again. And we were getting close to having to do it a third time, but that third one may have sunk the movie because we had a lot of crew members on hold and stuff like that, that just, you know, eventually they needed to work and take another job or whatever. We would have run into pilot season, or there's all kinds of stuff going on. And kind of in the 11th hour, she came in and really blew our minds. And then we surprised her in the audition and threw like another two scenes at her, I think, that she'd never even read, that were really long. And she dealt with that with, you know, as much tact as a person can when you throw something like that at them. She was really amazing in those as well. And could take
didn't direction. Know until later how much she like cursed.
Oh, I knew.
Oh, you knew it at the moment? Oh,
I mean, she almost blew a gasket when I was like, here, do this one now. Because she put, you know, and come with, as you get to know her, you realize how much she preparation cracks. She does for everything, and to be like, hey, good luck, improv. So, you know, and she still killed. And I knew that I wasn't going to hold her to the same standard as the stuff that she had rehearsed. Nobody wants to turn in a not great performance. So, but she did an amazing job, and everybody, for the first time, everybody's like, yes, her, she's great. And she only got better, which was exciting. On set, we would do a scene and we'd play it back and be like, wow, like, I think we are witnessing a star being born here. So that was an exciting experience. And I think,
yeah, I mean, that's kind
of going to go far.
That's kind of what I was going to say, that it, like, watching it, it does feel like you definitely made the right decision. It does feel like a kind of star making turn, I feel.
Hope so. I mean, she's already in Star Wars, so now this is her real star making.
I saw that. Yeah. Looking over credit.
And I remember just thinking, because it happened so quickly from like the audition to just showing up on set and getting going, I was just like, did she read this whole script? Because again, you said spoiler free, but there's a lot of stuff that happens in this movie, especially to our protagonist. And I would think like, oh my God, hopefully she like at least skimmed it, so she knows what she's saying yes to. And she was down for every single thing on every single page and to the fullest extent that she could do it. It was incredible.
Yeah,
she was a great sport. And one of the things that I was really impressed by is that you'll see in the film, there are a couple scenes where she's, you know, she encounters some things that are quite terrifying and some practical things. And she wanted to wait and truthfully encounter those on camera and not kind of get comfortable ahead of time before we rolled. And, you know, kind of channel that fear and capture it for us. And that's a brave thing to do. So I know we're all really impressed about that.
Yeah. So I don't want to spoil the movie too much, obviously, but I did want to talk about one scene where the protagonist encounters some snakes.
Mm-hmm. That's in the trailer too, so no spoilers.
Yeah, okay.
And it's early. That's early in the movie, I think. That's...
Yeah, no, like it doesn't. Yeah, it's, yeah.
Also, if you're listening to this podcast, pause it now. Go find it. Go stream it, and then come on back in 90 minutes, and we'll listen to the rest.
It should be available on Netflix right now, theoretically.
Yeah. It will be available on Netflix right now when this podcast goes out.
So steal your mom's account. Log in,
watch it. Do whatever you gotta snake, do.
the snake scene is in particular pretty harrowing. You know, she we had built, she's tied up with ropes, like drawn and quartered basically. And our prop guy Derek had built the ropes specially so that they had kind of Velcro quick release things, so that if she got concerned or whatever, she could just, you know, whip right out of it. And she was like, no, I don't want those, give me the real ropes, really tie me up because I don't want to fake it. I was like, all right, if you you know, and we kept time and time again throughout the whole process of the movie, we would show up with the, like, I don't know, G version of the stuff for her so that we weren't putting her out any more than we had to. And she would always refuse it and want it to be as real and kind of method as possible. So that was a real thing that she wanted to do there. And then when the man showed up with the snakes, the snake wrangler, I guess you call him, he had 3 or 4 snakes he brought, even though the scene only calls for 2. And I went up to her. She was probably in the dressing room or getting her makeup done or something. And I was like, do you want to come meet the snakes now and pet them and just see that they're not, in the real world, they're not venomous and they're not dangerous, and but they're very scary looking. She was like, no, I don't want to see them at all. I was like, well, do you like snakes? And she's like, no, I don't like snakes. I don't particularly dislike them, but I've been trained my whole life to be scared of them from movies. So she's like, but I want to witness it the way the character witnesses it. And they're like, all right. And they come, you know, they come up from behind her, like she's tied up and not facing them. So it's pretty prone. And we were actually on camera. We actually have her real first time experience when they touch her. And that's in the cut. And it, you can't fake it, you know, it's pretty amazing what she put herself through to get something onto the screen that feels authentic and visceral and real.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore.
Do you have any specific questions about that scene? Sorry.
It wasn't kind of a specific question. I mean, like, I suppose that, you kind of answered within your answer, you answered the kind of specifics of, like, you know, you mentioned that they weren't venomous, and that's one of the things I was wondering. And you mentioned that the fear or not fear of snakes, and, you know, like, so there's that. The kind of specific points that I was going to hit were kind of answered within your answer.
Yeah.
Cool. If you're wondering their name, Indy and Sarah Michelle Gellar. Is that
Indy
correct?
And Sarah Michelle Gellar? Is that what you said?
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. I think those are the two snakes that we end up using. But the coolest thing about those snakes, Chris, you should tell them about the eye.
Oh, yeah. So you'll see in the movie you can see in the trailer too, like the Bruja Luce, she has a, one of her eyes is like, kind of cataract over, it's white, kind of spooky looking. And the guy showed up with the snakes and he said, I brought 4, I can't remember, around 4 snakes. And he's like, unfortunately, the biggest and best one, my favorite snake, started molting last night. And her skin is fine still, but the first thing, I guess, to go is the eye turns white. And I was like, he's like, so I'm really sorry, but I have 3 other snakes and they're really good and they're fine, but this one's a little bigger. And I was like, oh, that's the best news I could have ever heard. Like, I couldn't have asked you to show up with a white-eyed snake, but he did, and we used it and rolled with it, and it's just a great layer in the movie. I mean, nobody's going to notice except for your dedicated face here, but it's pretty cool, you know, for the rewatchability to see that the snake has white eyes. And that scene,
I did notice that actually. Yeah.
And there's a bunch of, we did a bunch of VFX in this movie, but this scene in particular has 0. These are all completely real, no split screens, no tricks other than, you know, there's like a guy off screen poking them with a stick, trying to get them to go in the direction that they're supposed to go. But they behaved exactly
incredibly
as the script called for, which was shocking to me, because I've worked with a lot of animals and you plan for failure with them because they'll just kind of do what they want sometimes. And we had a whole backup plan for how we would film the scene if they weren't behaving properly, or if Bridget like had a meltdown or something when they got on her or whatever. You never know what's going to happen. And it just went so well and so as planned that we were pinching ourselves the whole time watching the footage, because it just was playing out exactly as Marcus had written it.
And then as you had storyboarded it, you know, it's just like, it's going to come over here and then over the thigh and then up the leg and all. And it did. Those things hit all their marks, even blind, even with cataract eyes.
And people are asking, they're like, man, the VFX on those snakes are amazing. I was like, no, you know why it looks so good? It's because they're real, and we didn't do any, we did nothing. In fact, there's one shot that I wanted to mess with a little bit, and I decided not to, just so I could say that there was no no VFX in that scene.
Right.
Yeah.
Talking about the VFX, both yourself, Chris, and yourself, Marcus, are listed amongst the visual effects team. What visual effects did you do?
Yeah, we did almost all of them. I mean, it was me and Marcus and a guy named Nick, and then my friend Dave DJ. Jacobson helped out on one shot. But yeah, it was the three of us. I think I did 100 shots. Nick did 100 shots, and Marcus did 50. And it was a lot of work. It was a lot of pandemic YouTube Googling
tutorials,
and, looking at tutorials, and because I have some background in motion graphics and VFX, but there was a lot of stuff in this that I hadn't planned on doing myself. But we had nothing but time, I guess, last year. So there's a lot of smoke. I mean, we did as much as we could practical, but there are certain things like having smoke behave as if it has a consciousness.
An entity,
is not something we were able to do on set. So I had to learn a lot about fluid simulations and rendering smoke elements and stuff like that. And we ended up enhancing the face of the demon. We shot a real
spoiler. Pause it. Yeah. Go to Netflix. Well, continue, Chris.
That'll be spoiled, like on the splash screen,
on the thumbnail
on Netflix. Shot a real man in a real suit that we created from scratch, and it looked amazing. But we didn't have the money to make it be fully articulated and expressive and stuff like that. So we did some digital face replacements for that, where I had to learn how to sculpt in 3D and rig and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, probably of the 25, 30 shots of that thing in the movie, maybe 10 of them or so, we had to
mess with
digitally enhance.
And it all kind of speaks to what Chris said earlier about, like, when you write a movie, especially an indie movie, you kind of start with what you have. So it's like, oh, we have this set and we have this stage and we could build something. And the same approach was taken with, like, the script and the visual effects that I knew were going to be, or that we knew we were going to put in the movie. Everything was like just inches or feet away from what we were comfortable with knowing we could pull off. So we didn't want to just like go like, hey, I think this is easy and we can do this kind of visual effect, because that wasn't going to be enough in our minds. But we also knew what we couldn't do. Like, there's no way we can do something, you know, do a whole set replacement or do something, you know, make this demon 50 feet tall. Like, there were going to be things we knew we couldn't accomplish in a way that we'd be satisfied with, because we wanted to do everything to the, like, utmost of our talents. So everything was, you know, like Chris said, he didn't mean to, we had someone else in mind to do, like, oh, we can do smoke sims and this guy's really good at it and this fire thing. And when it came down to it, Chris had to learn that stuff. And then a lot of the other visual effects are, you know, paint outs and removals of, you know, things. And we knew how to do a lot of that stuff and, you know, could wrap our minds around it. So that's how it ends up in the script, to go like, okay, we're going to do, you know, maybe a levitation thing or something over here or whatever. And we kind of know how we're going to accomplish that before we set out to attempt it. And we shoot it in a way that we can, and then just spend enough time in production getting it right. And it was fun, actually, it really felt like what we, you know, started doing in college, where it's like, we're going to shoot it and then we're going to do this kind of visual effect. Let's try it. Let's see what happens. And it was a lot of fun discovery, and love it.
Scott, visual effects, I'm sure you're aware, are damn expensive.
Yes.
And I remember when I came on board, I took a look at the budget that had been generated before me, and you know, there really wasn't anything in there for visual effects. I remember going to Chris and being like, hey, there's a little hole here, and you know, reading the script,
there's about a million dollar hole here.
I know we're trying to be real tight here, and you know, this, we really didn't have a lot to work with, what's going on with this? It's like, oh, well, I'm going to probably handle that. And Mark's going to do that. We're going to figure it out. And I'm like, oh, so you know how to do this? Cause these are some pretty complex shots. He's like, not yet, but you know, we're going to learn. And
the principles.
Yeah. But it's like,
we knew we could do something.
Yeah.
And if we were the bosses of it, you know, we could determine what we wanted it to be. It's harder when someone else, if someone else is directing the movie besides Chris and they're like, this is what I want. Then it's like, well, we're screwed because there's no way we can actually accomplish what you want. But if we can tailor expectations to what we can do and, you know, create the visual language that's proper for it, then yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I know. And it's funny because even like Bridget in reading the script, because we were talking about like, does she know what's up? We asked her one time, like, what did you think when you saw all that stuff? And she was like, I thought it was going to be more visual effects, like more computer.
He's like, yeah, I put a lot of faith in the computer doing stuff. And we're like, nope, we're really pulling stuff out of you. Really tying you down. We're really dumping goat milk down your throat. Spoiler. Yeah. We used almond.
Spoiled goat milk.
But it was I feel like you guys, having seen this movie and having seen other films you're connected with, like The Mortuary Collection and like The Wind, that you're fans of practical effects and things, because there's all three of those films have some gnarly effects in them.
Yeah. Thanks. And I think that comes from, like, if you know visual effects, if you work with visual effects, then you know what the pluses and minuses are. I think sometimes a director who maybe doesn't, or a production company who doesn't fully understand it, would be like, yeah, and then CG and it'll be that. But we know, like, oftentimes the limitations of even movies that have multi-million dollar budgets, you still look at it and you're like, that didn't look that great. And it's like, dude, that's the best it could possibly ever be. And if you do it practically, then it's what it is. You have the opportunity of having an incredible DP lens it right and look at it and be like, oh man, that looks good. And you can watch the playback and be like, holy crap, that looks really good. And if it doesn't look good, you can do it again. And you can solve those problems in production versus fixing it in post.
Especially 5 or 10 years later, you know, you watch it and you're like, oh, okay, that would have, you know, benefited from more RAM or something. Yeah. But, you know, if you have real goo on set, it's like, that's the best goo you're ever going to get.
That's like why, you know, The Thing, the John Carpenter The Thing, holds up so much better than the later prequel The Thing, because you can still watch The Thing. And it's not, you never look at a movie with practical effects and think, well, you can think it's a little dated, but like, it's dated for other reasons. And it's not just dated. I mean, there are movies that rely on a lot of CG, especially horror movies, that you can't even like stomach. You're just like, oh God, I can't look at this. There's nothing enjoyable about this. So it's true. We knew from like day one. I mean, again, going back to the script, we had lots of opportunities to not do certain things in this movie, but we would talk about it and go like, you know, Chris and I would discuss like, hey, so towards the end of this, there's going to be like a real physical demon, right? Like a dude in a puppet suit or whatever. We're going to figure out, we're going to build a monster. And the answer was yes, so that we could plan for it in the whole time, instead of like, well, it's going to be something evergreen and then we'll design it later and we'll figure it out. You know, there's just such a tangible quality of like, when you make those decisions and show up on set and have to answer to it, then it's just like super cool.
And you're always going to get a better performance as well if they're playing against, you know, a suit, a creature that's actually there and hiding in the shadows versus a tennis ball.
And there's a, you know, there's a man in the suit, Weston Meredith, who's a real actor and also happens to specialize in kind of body movement and stuff like that. Yeah. So he can speak the language, the actor's language, with our actors and they can form a sort of, you know, choreography or a dance together on set that, that, you know, ones and zeros could never really recreate, I don't think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I agree with Marcus's point as well, that like a lot of CGI heavy movies date way quicker than movies that have practical effects. It's just like, you know, Marcus, you were talking about The Thing. I think that still holds up. I recently rewatched Escape from LA. Some of the worst CGI ever seen.
Wow. You can't watch that movie.
At the time, I don't think it was impressive either.
No, it wasn't great.
Because remember, it was like the same summer of like Jurassic Park.
Yeah, so it's like,
yeah. Escape from LA actually came out 3 years after Jurassic Park and looks a lot
worse. Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh,
yeah, it was goodness. Like Terminator 2 or something. There was some other really big movie that year.
The biggest movie of that year was Independence Day.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That, oh my God.
There's some pretty decent. I mean, there's a ton of practical effects in that movie too, though. So. But yeah, when you see, of course, Escape from LA was not a $200 million movie. But Escape from New York looks pretty good.
Surprising that Chris comes to the defense of Escape from LA. Like, I love that movie. It's amazing. Just
gotta stick up for low budget movies.
That's right.
It wasn't that low budget. It's like the one of the highest budget that John Carpenter ever had. Yeah, it was expensive.
You're confusing Escape from New York because that was really low at the time.
Escape from New York.
Reading that was very low. Yeah. And a lot of practical effects in that.
So. Yeah, that had James Cameron, his hand in there.
That's right.
He did the grids.
He did the hologram maps, the digital maps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, that's why that was good.
It all comes back to James Cameron. every time.
God damn it.
Piranha 2, The Spawning. Also an impressive James Cameron movie.
There you go.
I mean, it's a James Cameron movie. I mean, impressive, and Piranha 2, The Spawning is probably the first time that those things have happened in a sentence.
True.
So cutting back to your guys' movie. One of the things I was going to ask you were saying, like, you've been for all the press and stuff like that. You've been behind these screens. Like, I know you premiered at Stitches, and that I think that had some in-person stuff.
Not these people, but it had people. Because we weren't allowed, Americans weren't allowed to travel to the EU at the time. So I think they did three in-person screenings of our film there, plus some virtual. And you know, I guess it was well received. I don't know. We that's where we sold it on the backs of that. And that's why it's now playing on Netflix. So I guess it was well received there, but we didn't get to see it with people at all until in April. Marcus and I and the producers got to go down to Florida for an in-person screening. And I mean, I didn't even see it with my editor until we were in the mix for the movie. So it was a very remote process during post, and it has been ever since. And even, you know, it'll come out on Netflix, and we still, you know, that'll just be people at their houses, hopefully all across the world. But, it's been weird. We were really, and Sitges in particular was on our mind the entire time we were making the movie. We were like, that would be the coolest festival to have a premiere at, because part of it is in Spanish, and that's such a beloved horror festival and amazing location for any sort of event. So when we got in, we were ecstatic, and then when we slowly came to realize we wouldn't get to go, it was a little more depressing. But you know, there's always the next one.
They work pretty hard to try to get us out there, the Sitges folks, and the Spanish consulate here in LA, but at the end of the day, it just was too much. But they did make an effort to get us over there.
Well, that's good of them.
Yeah. I hear it's a heck of a good time, so I'm sad that we missed it.
I've heard it's a great festival.
It's almost like a curse now. Oh, my God. I ran into a couple people just last week who were mentioning, like, oh, you guys played Sitges. God, it's such a good festival, isn't it? I had the best time of my life there. I'm like, what? Don't tell me that. We didn't get to go. So apparently we missed a heck of a party even during COVID.
Oh, that's a shame.
And The Wind played there, and I had just come off a few more festivals with it, and I was like, I guess I can't go to this one, but one day I'll have a movie that I directed that'll play there, sort of.
Welcome back for the 20-year retrospective. So stream it a bunch of times.
There you go.
Again, I'm just plugging that stream. Get on now. What are you people doing? Get on now. Press play.
Turn it on the background. You can watch it when we're done.
Just keep it on loop.
Yeah.
we definitely recommend all our listeners do exactly that. Just
thank you, Scott. I'll send you the $20 later.
that's what I'm in this podcast game for.
Getting that rich podcast money, baby. MeUndies.com. Casper mattress.
Shave Club.
Dollar Shave. Harry's Dollar Shave Club.
Oh yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've not quite reached that level yet where I'm like sponsored by Blue Chew or something, you know, like
this is
what's the big like UK podcast sponsors these days? Is it all the same as the US one?
I've recently been listening to a lot of US podcasts, but like here it's like there's Now TV is big. That seems to be sponsoring a lot of people. Things like Squarespace. I hear a lot of Squarespace.
That's a big one here.
But I know from listening to like a lot of American ones as well. The big ones seem to be like Blue Chew, Feels the CBD thing, and I can't remember what there's another one that I had in mind. But anyway, yeah. Yeah,
we did a commercial for with the Muppets. We do a lot of Muppets stuff, and we did a commercial for the UK for a crumpets company. Are they crumpets?
Warburtons. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, Warburtons. Yeah. Yeah, so we did that. So I was hoping they would sponsor this because
Sainsbury. Everybody. We did that.
I was like, wow, these are that popular in the UK. This is exciting. Crumpets.
Yeah, a big bread company. Yeah, yeah, they make bread and crumpets and all sorts.
We just call them English muffins, but I guess you guys just call them muffins.
Wait.
This podcast has taken a turn. Are there no muffins?
Are there no muffins over there?
No, we call those American muffins. This is not right. Yeah. Okay, what we call a muffin is different. It's just like, I don't know, like... Yeah. Oh
my God. This muffin talk is brought to you by Squarespace.
Squarespace.
Started a professional looking website today.
Squarespace. Yeah, if we just keep seeing all the sponsors, I'm sure they'll come.
They will. Yeah. Promo code Scott. Oh well. One day. Check out that Warburton's commercial. It's great.
Dear. I was actually going to ask that, like in terms of like looking up your IMDb credits, I thought it was quite funny. That both you, Chris, and you, Marcus, that you look at your IMDb credits, and it's like the last thing you did before this was like Muppets Now, and I was just thinking, in terms of a headspace shift, that must
there's
be
nothing
something.
More terrifying than the Muppets.
It's funny. Like I don't think of it like that. To me, it's like everything I do has a cartoon or a puppet or some world building or some movie magic in it. So, I mean. My process on set is not really any different when I'm doing Muppet stuff or horror, and timing and tone and everything are really important for comedy just as much as they are for horror. So it seems different when you look at the final product, but like, you know, when you're in the meat grinder, it's very similar. And that's why we do have a lot of experience removing wires and rods and dealing with puppeteers and knowing how to make things that are not real look real, and you know, because it's a green sock, you know, but you 100% believe he's alive and can speak and has a soul and a personality. So on our side of the lens, it's a very similar equation. I think you go through just, you know, but it's fun to do something R-rated after you've done a lot of G-rated stuff. So
yeah, it's just, you know, cleanser. It's the same kind of script, but then I just go through and do a pass where I just like add 25% more vomit and a little more viscera, some goo.
But we've entrails. Done, you know, we've done.
You accidentally put animal scenes. In the script and stuff.
You should animal. You have to remove all the vomit and viscera stuff when you write for animal. Yeah, look, it's a hodgepodge of like our general interests. Like Chris and I have known each other since we were 19 years old, and we're lucky enough to. Have a company in Soapbox that gets to work on movie marketing, gets to work on TV series and commercials, and then gets to also develop feature films. And the connective tissue to all of that is like, we just enjoy stories and we enjoy what we enjoy. So I love horror movies. It's been a language that I've loved to speak for a long, long time. Chris loves genre films as well. Sci-fi, horror, all those, the fantasy. So if we can, that's why this movie for us is really like, it's everything we could put into a movie without going overboard, you know, like there's a budget to it, but there's elements in this movie that are fantastic. And in the fantasy sense, there are elements in this movie that are otherworldly, and there are elements of this movie that are truly terrifying and horrific. And then hopefully there's like moments of levity and a little bit of connective tissue there. And those come like everything that we have and everything that we can speak to and create outside of in the rest of our lives went into this movie. Yeah. And so
for me, it all started with Star Wars, and mm-hmm. that's got very scary scenes in it and Muppets in it and science fiction and magic. So it just kind of is the well that all that stuff springs from. So this is just, and like they're doing with like the Muppet or the Star Wars spinoffs, where they're kind of leaning more into a genre that is part of the bigger genre, like mm-hmm. Mandalorian is just kind of like pure Western. But that was always a part of Star Wars too, but now they have a Western TV show. So
yeah,
I think that was just a huge influence on me because it came out the year I was born and was like the first movie I saw. So I think everything can get traced back to that type of thing, but also, I mean, find me one horror fan who doesn't love the Muppets. I think you'd be hard pressed.
Good luck.
Yeah.
That's a fair point. Now.
Go. Take a poll.
Yeah.
I've no idea. Any listeners who want to write in, like, I love the Muppets. The Muppets Christmas Carol is my favorite Christmas movie. So like, so anybody who wants to comment and don't like the Muppets.
There are going to be some Muppet
about to start a Muppet war. MFers I know.
And the perfect version of it is we just finished producing. Wait, this is announced.
No, I don't know. I don't know. Oh. Okay. Hey man. That's you.
Well, check out Disney Plus around Halloween, and you'll be pretty excited about some other stuff we're doing. It's out.
Oh, I mean, it is announced. It is announced. Yes. Yeah, good. You want to say it? Now? I'm not doing it.
anticipation.
I don't want to get in trouble, but
it is announced. But just Google Muppets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not going to get crushed by Disney now. Please tell me.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, it's, I'm scared to be crushed.
a really, really cool Halloween special for the Muppets will be coming
that
out.
That really links up the two things we're just talking together. About, Sky. It ties it all together. The horror element. Listen, not, by this point, I've announced it, but the horror elements, the Muppets elements.
The rainbow connection.
Our magnum opus.
Yeah, it brings it all together. It's very exciting.
That's perfect. That's perfect. I suppose we're nearing the end of the interview, but
wait, did you say nearing the end of me?
The interview.
Oh, the interview.
Nearing the end of yes, I've been slowly dying.
We're nearing the end of you. The interview. Like, wow, that's a very dark way to end an interview.
I'm coming to an end.
I've done enough. I've done. This is like my 105th interview or something. Like it's enough. I'm packing it in.
I wanted to be number 100. Who wants to be 105?
I'm sorry. Nicholas Vince, who played the Chatterer in Hellraiser, was number 100.
All right, that's pretty good.
That's cool.
That's a pretty good one.
The Chatterer.
Yeah, I can say it. It's out on Variety. Muppets Go Spooky with Haunted Mansion Halloween special dropping this fall on Disney Plus.
Oh, that's brilliant. So I will not be raided by the forces of Disney. That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
This might be the last movie we ever get to make once Disney comes after us.
It was a good run.
It was a good run.
Yeah.
It's good. Yeah. Grand and it seems to be getting a great response. You've got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. You must be very happy about the response it has received at festivals and the critical response so far.
Yeah, we're excited. You know, I mean, we're hoping to get more reviews in there so we can get that old certified thing. But for now, we're sitting pretty at 100. So we'll take that. It's pretty exciting. I'm just excited to get it in front of like regular movie going mm-hmm. audience. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's definitely been weighted because we've been in a lot of genre festivals but it's good, you know, because I don't think anyone's going to be more harsh than like a real horror fan, but we'll see.
Have you been on Reddit?
Yeah.
People will be very harsh.
We'll see what someone who's expecting this to be a romantic comedy thinks when they accidentally click on it. So.
Charming romantic getaway to Veracruz.
I love the Caribbean.
Oh, dear.
So we need more reviews.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I was going to ask is there any possibility we will see a continuation of the story?
Listen, press play on Netflix right now. There's three more times. you know, we'd love to. Go ahead, Chris.
If it performs and there's an appetite for it, I mean, you'll see in the movie there's a book. It's called The Red Book. That's got basically it's like a recipe book handed down from generation to generation of brujas that has every demon they've ever encountered and every horrible thing. And it's like a comprehensive novella. We actually made the book, and there's a bunch of demons that we fleshed out a little more than you normally would just for like a prop. Mm-hmm. We've got some really cool ideas for how we could make this either a series or more films, but it's really just a matter of, do people want it?
And yeah, is there nothing would make us happier than to keep doing it. But you know, it's the story of, I mean, this is a true independent film in the way that, you know, independent films are meant to be. And you know, we have to kind of perform and prove that there are people who want to hear this story. And you know, I think there are. We just have to make sure they get to see it. Yeah. And that's the nice thing about Netflix, is the widest audience possible. I mean, that is like the worldwide distribution for it. So as long as it doesn't just get like buried underneath the algorithm and has a chance to kind of come to the surface and be found, hopefully people will receive it as well as we hope. We certainly made this movie with audiences in mind, not just, well, genre audiences, definitely. We dreamed of like, what will happen at Sitges when this moment happens, or what will happen at this film festival when this happens on screen. And it's just, you know, rotten circumstances that has made it that we couldn't do that, but it doesn't mean that we didn't make this movie dreaming of our audience the whole time and being like, how dope is this going to be when this happens?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the score is amazing. We worked with Ben Levitt, who did The Wind. He did the Ritual, the forthcoming, Night House by David Bruckner. He's a genius composer. We mixed the audio and Atmos. It's a real movie, you know. So don't just watch on your iPhones if you can't get away with it.
Juan Campos, re-recording mixer, same guy who did the Mortuary Collection. If you like all those splats and subtle nuances that he built out in that world, he brought the heat on this one again.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Nice. Yeah.
Wow. And I just say about Netflix, I mean, we're excited to be there. And it's, again, great to be able to reach so many people. But like Marcus said, it's kind of terrifying too, because it is so big, we could get lost. So if you guys do check out the movie and you like it, it's kind of vital to spread the word about it initially and let people know. Because if people watch it in the first week or two, then it can stay up there and other people can get to see it and spread the word as well. But if not a lot of people talk about it in the first week or two, then it could easily kind of disappear and get lost in the shuffle and become one of those, hopefully, classics like 10 years down the road. But you know, we obviously want people to discover it now and kind of keep the momentum going. So if you dig it, please tell people about it.
Nice. Yeah. This segment brought to you by Squarespace. Sponsored the ad. Old ways. By the old way.
Yeah, absolutely. Promo code NHE. Yes. Well, it's been great having you all on Likewise. The show. And yes, I do recommend to all my listeners to check out The Old Ways, and I will be putting the link for it in the show notes, so you can just go down to the show notes and watch it directly after listening to this episode. And like Justin says, you know, retweet it, you know, talk about it, and because I'd like to see this film get the audience that I think it deserves. So yeah, it's great to have you all on, Christopher, Justin. Justin is his name, and Marcus.
J-Dog.
No, that does here.
Yeah, appreciate it. Well, thank you so much. Great chat.
Yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time and spreading the word and getting it out there into the Scottish area of the world. It's exciting. We're hoping to get to go to Edinburgh someday.
Great.
See a movie. in a castle.
They don't really do that, but yeah, okay.
We'll do it.
See a movie.
Don't kill the dream.
Just for you guys.
you guys got extra castles there, right?
We're all stomped up on castles. We're all done. Yeah. This is the extra bonus content. But now
the second hour brought to you by
inflatable castles where you can project the movie on them.
Yes.
.com.
This episode has been brought to you by Visit Scotland. We'll just keep saying things and maybe we'll get sponsored. But I suppose the episode has to end sometime. So probably best right about now. That was my guests, Christopher, Marcus, and Justin there, all of whom I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. I'd also like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Also, remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. And if you can make those reviews 5 stars, that would be absolutely amazing, as it really helps us with those old algorithms. Unfortunately, that is all for this time, but be sure to join me again in 2 weeks' time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.